Welcome, Dumbheads, to this week's Megasode of MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Monday through Saturday, I drop one episode per day, identifying the dumbest thing on every single goddamn page of Heroes Unlimited, the gloriously ramshackle superhero RPG from Palladium Books. On Sundays, I combine all the week's previous episodes in one Megasode, like this one. If you'd like to play along at home, we're reading Heroes Unlimited Revised 2nd Edition, 2nd Printing, from December 1998. Today we're discussing page 300 of Heroes Unlimited. It's an exciting day. The podcast, if you can believe it, is winding down. There is no page 400. This is our last centennial episode. And what better way to celebrate than that most exciting style of MDC episode, a dry CSI-style investigation of how a single innocuous two-word phrase ended up on this particular page. To be fair to myself, it's slightly more interesting than that. At least I think so. Here's what led me to undertake this investigation. Two simple words. They occur at the end of the psychic purification, psionic power. We are, of course, still in the psionic abilities section, in the subsection for healing psionic abilities. And here's the rules text for the psychic purification ability. Quote, the healer can use his abilities to slow a person's metabolism and destroy chemicals, drugs, poisons, and toxins in the body. The effects of the drugs slash impurities are immediately halted at the beginning of the meditation and completely destroyed slash negated by its end. Damage sustained prior to the psychic's intervention still exists. This power is ineffective against magic potions, spells, and fairy foods. Now, as you know, if you've been listening to these episodes about the psionic abilities section, I've been on the back foot a little bit. I've been somewhat out of my depth trying to analyze this section because the psionic rules are so old, everything is so strange here. We're constantly being inundated with rules and concepts that are not from Heroes Unlimited. Everything just feels a little off. And this sentence is a great example. This power is ineffective against magic potions, spells, and fairy foods. Okay, spells, sure. Magic is well established in this game. There are characters who know spells, and apparently you can't use psychic purification to deal with the effects of those spells. Fair enough. Magic potions, as we've mentioned before, they do crop up in these rules from time to time. As it turns out, there's only one magic potion in Heroes Unlimited, the magic sleep potion created by the sleep spell. But nonetheless, magic potions get a surprising amount of press in this game, usually in the context of, this won't help you against magic potions, you are fucked. But fairy foods, there are no fairy foods listed in this game. There are no other mentions of fairy foods in this game. As far as I know, there are no fairies mentioned in this game. I can't even think of any rules that would be broadly applicable to fairy food in this game. What are we doing here? Why are we talking about this? Especially in the context of, like, this doesn't apply. It would be one thing if there were some random spell or superpower, you know, super eating, super consumption, like from the Rifter number one, and it gave you total freedom to eat everything, and maybe it had a note on it that said, you can even eat fairy foods without harm. Then sure, like, even though we have no context for what fairy foods are, just in case you ever meet a fairy, just in case they ever try to trick you into eating a banquet so you have to stay in their fairy realm forever, fuck those fairies. You can eat whatever you want. You're matter eater, lad. I'm from the planet Bismol, son. Your fairy magic has no sway over me. But no, this is a power that doesn't interact with fairy foods, but still feels the need to mention it. I wondered why. And because of the clues we've seen in this section so far, I thought the answer had to lie in other Palladium games. So I went on this kind of journey that involved a lot of reading, a lot of investigating, a lot of downloading, and I tried to figure out, where did this text come from, and why was it added? Here are the results of that investigation. Psionic powers appear all the way back in The Mechanoid Invasion, which was a three-part series of books published in 1981. It was the first role-playing game to come out of Palladium. Now, I have no doubt that these episodes, Megadumbcast, will survive in perpetuity. People will no doubt be binging this podcast years, decades in the future. If studying Palladium has taught me nothing else, it's that amateurishly produced labors of love will inexplicably thrive for decades on end. But whether you're listening to this in 2018 or 2020, 1981, a long time ago, right? Almost 40 years ago, as of the time of this recording. Already we had psionic powers that would be familiar to a Rifts player playing right now in 2018. Bioregeneration, mind block, resist hunger, spontaneous combustion, etc. A lot of the language and the rules on the psionics at that stage are very simple. For me, at least, I get the sense that this is like before other people got in Kevin Sambita's ear with lots of questions and comments about his writing, because it is much less concerned with like corner cases and needless clarifications than it would later become. These psionic powers from Mechanoids are often copied word for word, but modified for the setting when you turn to Palladium Fantasy RPG First Edition. This is the first big game from Palladium, their first like ongoing line of games. It has psionics, because, you know, they have some fantasy pedigree. D&D had psionics, so why not Palladium Fantasy? And yeah, a lot of times it's just copied and pasted straight out of Mechanoids. Only a few things are changed to fit into a fantasy setting, because at this early stage in his career, the author still had fucks left to give about whether the things he was cutting and pasting actually belonged in the new RPG. Like, if we're going to physically paste this chunk of our old game into our new game, the least we can do is, like, paste on a couple more lines to account for the fact that, you know, we're fighting orcs, not robots now. Now, in the first edition of Palladium Fantasy, there's a fleeting mention of fairy food in the core book, but there's no real development of the idea, and there's no such power as psychic purification yet. So this is still early days in the history of Palladium psionics, and fairy food is only a glimmer in Kevin Sambita's eye. The next stop on our historical tour of Palladium is Beyond the Supernatural First Edition. Beyond the Supernatural, as we've often talked about, is the like occult, monster, psychic magic conspiracy type game that Palladium produces. It's a fairly old game line for them, and I think it did a lot to develop these psionic rules in the direction of modern horror. So Beyond the Supernatural First Edition does have a psychic purification power, and it does use basically the same language that we find here in Heroes Unlimited Second Edition. But that last sentence, "this power is ineffective against magic potions, spells, and fairy foods," is missing. It seems to me like this is where the basic language of the power originates. Mind you, Beyond the Supernatural First Edition was published in 1987. So this is early days. We're 6 years out from Mechanoids, but more than 10 years away from Heroes Unlimited Second Edition. And already the basic language is in place. Now, of course, Palladium's magnum opus is Rifts. And when Rifts First Edition comes out, you know, it's got psionics, of course, because it has everything. And it too has psychic purification. Same language, still missing that last sentence, despite the fact that fairies are presumably running wild over everybody on Rift's Earth. It's extremely magical, there's a lot less civilization, and player characters are all basically weirdos with weird powers who are out seeking magical spots in the woods, so you would expect them to run into fairies from time to time. Yet still, no mention of fairy food. Finally, we arrive at this language in Palladium Fantasy 2nd Edition. We find a version of psychic purification with the caveat that it doesn't affect fairy food, at the same time that we get an expanded section on fairy food in that same book. So fairy food becomes a bigger deal, we get the fairy food caveat added as a final sentence to the end of psychic purification, and apparently that version just gets copied and pasted whole into Heroes Unlimited 2nd Edition. But here's the thing, if you look to psychic surgery, another power that's found on this page, you'll see that it has a very early pedigree. It's already in Mechanoids. And we can see from that that the level of attention paid to the copying and pasting is very inconsistent. Like, the version of psychic surgery from Mechanoids gets copied and pasted whole to Palladium Fantasy, First Edition. It gets rephrased in Beyond the Supernatural, though, to refer to modern medical care. That gets copied and pasted, though, back to Palladium Fantasy with the reference to modern medical care still intact. So it's not like every time they copy and paste their work, they check it to make sure it's still appropriate. They only check when they care. The rules text only changes when the author is motivated. And that motivation solves the mystery on this page of why the fairy food text shows up. To understand why the author cared enough to add this language about fairy food in the first place, but not enough to take it out of later versions of the rules, even in other books without fairies, you have to understand what happened in Palladium Fantasy 2nd Edition. Namely, that the author added a whole section about fairy food that is just chock full of dumb puns. As it turns out, fairy foods in Palladium Fantasy 2nd Edition basically are a GM item. There are no rules for creating fairy food. There are no particular rules for when you find them. They're just around. They're very expensive. You might get them from fairies or in fairy mounds, but generally speaking, the GM is tightly controlling these substances. We're talking about Schedule 2 fantasy pharmaceuticals here, tightly controlled, because they are jokes that you play on the player. For example, fairy beets make you violent. Get it? They make you beat people. Fairy squash reduces you to half size, and you shrink inside your clothes and gear, so you end up like a little tiny naked person. Fairy cinnamon sticks make you want to do sins for 1d6 months. fairy tarts make you flirtatious with the opposite sex, because I guess they also turn you straight. These are some very heteronormative fairies, not what I've come to expect from fairy magic. Likewise, a fairy beefcake, if you eat it and you're male, it makes you feel like you're handsome and, quote, studly, whereas if you eat it and you're female, it makes you fall in love with the first male you see. I would have accepted same effect regardless of gender, or swap those effects. That's much more fun, but, you know, as usual, a disappointing lack of queer content in Palladium games. All these fairies and not a gay to be found. Typical for an old school game book. Anyway, basically, these fairy foods are just a series of goofy, punish pranks to play on player characters, much more detailed in this edition than the throwaway line in the previous edition, which makes me think that the author either actually used or thoroughly planned a situation in his own game where he would afflict the player characters with silly, funny, haha fairy curses. And naturally, when you write a whole list of hilarious puns to spring on your players, you don't want your jokes ruined by a lot of killjoy psychic purification. Therefore, I believe the author went on a spree of adding ineffectiveness against fairy foods to various items throughout Palladium Fantasy. Indeed, every occurrence of the phrase fairy foods in Palladium Fantasy 2nd Edition is either an entry in the table of contents or the name of this very section, two instances of very small bonuses to save against fairy foods from niche abilities, and three instances of abilities that won't help you against fairy foods. It turns out almost the only thing that will help you against fairy foods is the Remove Curse spell, a fact that goes conveniently unnoted in the Remove Curse entry. The author did not bother to add a note anywhere about the things that do help against fairy foods, mostly just notes about things that won't work to solve a fairy food problem. Oh, and by the way, the other occurrences of the phrase fairy foods in the book are under various lore abilities, which allow you to not so much save yourself from fairy foods, but identify the effects of fairy foods, thereby allowing the GM to explain the joke. If one of the player characters has just developed a bunch of random mental disorders, and they don't know why, then they can go to anybody with a lore skill, basically, who can roll and say, oh, I see what happened. You're crazy now because you ate those fairy mixed nuts. Get it? Get it? So yeah, I think that was the motivator here. The author had a motivation to prevent psychic purification from working on fairy foods, so he bothered to add the language. He had no motivation to take out that reference, just because it makes no goddamn sense when he ported the power over to Heroes Unlimited, so he just left it there. Therefore, the dumbest thing on this page is not exactly the mention of fairy foods, but the fact that it's here because there was like one moment in the textual history of this power when the author gave enough of a damn to actually change the language to suit the game, and it happened about 10 years before Heroes Unlimited was published when he was excited about making stupid puns. Although, obviously, on a game design level, in the whole context of the Palladium Megaverse, it was worth it. Because, for example, if you eat fairy peanuts, then you wet yourself whenever you're under stress. I mean, that's a sterling addition to any campaign. Incidentally, because of the lesser role of magic in Heroes Unlimited compared to Palladium Fantasy, superheroes are really fucked if they eat fairy food. If you're listening to this right now and like slapping your knee like, what, peanuts? They make you pee? I can't wait to use this at my table. Superheroes are the ones to hit with this shit. The only way to get out of it basically is Remove Curse, which is an 11th level spell. It is very unlikely that there is anybody in your player character group or your NPC cast who can readily cast that spell. So if you feed some superheroes fairy peanuts, they're going to be peeing until you tell them to stop. Such is the legacy of the one time Kevin Sambita was motivated to update the rules. Today we're discussing page 301 of Heroes Unlimited. We've been talking about some meta kind of stuff. We've been talking about persnickety game design and, you know, investigating the text kind of stuff for a few days on the podcast, because we've been in this very alienating, very odd psionic section of the book. We got all these new ideas coming at us, many of them from outside of this game, from other role-playing games. Undefined terms, roll over percentile mechanics, which is just a dumb idea, even by Palladium standards. I haven't really known what to make of it, but today I feel at home, because today we got some good old-fashioned dumb shit for your player characters to do. We're now past the healing psionic powers, and we're onto the physical psionic powers, which are more comic booky, more overt in their effects. And today we're discussing ectoplasm. Ectoplasm is, of course, one of those kind of tonally liminal elements. It can be spooky if deployed well. You know, it's a trope of certain supernatural stories. There is this wispy, ethereal substance sort of makes up the bodies of ghosts or whatever. When you handle it really, really well, And with great care and in the proper context of mood and setting, Ectoplasm can achieve this kind of parapsychological thriller aspect to your supernatural story. Needless to say, it is not handled with anything like that kind of care here. Instead, it turns you into the goofiest fucking psychic on the block. Let me just give you the game's description of how Ectoplasm works. Quote, "This mystifying ability enables the psychic to create a slightly luminous, vapor-like substance that is extruded from the pores." So it's sort of like you're full of ghost taffy and you gotta pull it out of your big honking pores. Already the mystique is in peril. Quote, "Ectoplasm has two forms, an invisible vapor and a luminous solid state." So you get two for the price of one here, two kinds of ectoplasm. Number one is the vapor, described here as, quote, "a floating probing finger." And what you do is you pull this gaseous finger out of your pores, and then it just kind of like oozes out of you like a little tendril, and it goes around and does whatever your bidding is. Now, this version of ectoplasm is invisible, mostly. You can see it. Other psychics can see it. So it's no use trying to spook other psychics by like putting out candles with ectoplasm or slamming doors or whatever. That shit works on the rubes, but other psychics can see that you've got a little gassy tendril finger coming out of the pores in your T-zone, and that's what you're using to knock shit over. Also, anyone with See the Invisible can see it, so that includes animals. So cats and dogs, one great use of ectoplasm, honestly, would be to use it like a laser pointer and get cats to jump on people, because they could totally see ectoplasm. You could drag it all over the house and get them to follow it. Ectoplasm, although it is invisible, it is not immaterial. It can touch things. As a result, it can't like go through walls. And it says here, "A person walking into an ectoplasm stream may feel a slight sensation, like walking into a spider's web or brushing against a cotton ball. Often, a person will unwittingly walk into it and snag the stream of floating ectoplasm, pulling or stretching it along without being aware of it. In such cases, the psychic must maneuver the snagged portion to loop around the human obstruction." So, already we're into hijinks here. We're like not even through the first paragraph of describing your luminous vapor that you extend from your mind, and already we're onto what can go wrong. You know, maybe you're trying to put on a seance and you're like reaching over across the room to like dramatically open a book to the correct page so that people see what you want them to see. Trying to impress these rubes who've hired you as a psychic. And then here comes their bozo roommate walking across to go get a beer during the seance. And he tangles himself all up in your psychic finger. Now it's all stretched out halfway across the room. And you're trying to keep up your psychic patter. And meanwhile, you keep like glancing over to the corner of the room, trying to like maneuver it over his head. It's all in the kitchen now. He's trying to get his beer open and like your psychic projection is all tangled up in his sweater. You also have to be able to see the ectoplasm to alter its course or to move it around. So if somebody does snag on it and pull it out of the room, then you can't move the part that they pull out of the room. So basically you've got this very light, very wispy, very invisible kind of toilet snake that you're extending around the room trying to do magic tricks with it. And then should the slightest thing go wrong, should you turn it wrong or should somebody walk by, then it gets all tangled up and you got to try to like reel it back in. Now it's in the other room. What is it even caught on? Here, let me retract it and try again. Oh shit, it's stuck. You could just drop the power, but then you'd have to spend more inner strength points and project more of that shit out of the pores in your face. So anyway, that's form number one. That's vapor. You can also do solid ectoplasm if you want to get up to some real mischief. The vapor form is more for like cons, trying to look cooler than you are. It's like doing your own special effects. It's like you're not really enough of a psychic badass that when you walk into a room, the lights flicker. That's for like proper angels and demons and shit. But you can like have a little invisible wispy dangle coming out of your head that you can send over to like flick the light switch on and off. Do a little light switch rave when you walk into the room. Make it seem like you're more important. And incidentally and beneficially, totally confuse the cats in the apartment. Like, what is that guy doing with that big floppy finger? Why did they invite him over? But that's all parlor tricks. If you want to get down to business with some ectoplasm, you need the solid state of ectoplasm. Quote, "The solid state of ectoplasm can be a startling sight, for it is clearly visible to everyone. In this form, the ectoplasm can be shaped into an extra limb, such as a hand or arm and hand or tentacle or even a foot, because there's nothing more intimidating and mysterious than a bunch of goopy shit coming out the side of somebody's head, floating in the air, terminating in like a disembodied foot, floating there at shoulder level, ready to kick you in the upper chest if you approach too close to this master mentalist. Quote, "The ectoplasmic limb appears as a white, slightly luminous appendage connected to a trail of ectoplasm stretching back to its creator like a lifeline of silly putty." So I'm not making this shit up. It is like silly putty. It is a line, a strand, going from you, from your pores, remember, to this luminous object you have created. It goes on to say that in its solid form, ectoplasm can carry like 40 pounds. You can squeeze it through small spaces, but not as small as the vapor form. So if you convert it from a foot or a whatever into a little thin tentacle, then you can get it through like an inch wide opening. It goes on to say that you can even shape it into a face or like a full person if you want to. And therefore, quote, ectoplasmic images may explain apparitions reported during some seances. Although even among rubes who would hire a real psychic fuck up, like a character with the ectoplasm power, you'd have to be an exceptional rube to be taken in by like the floating, glowing ghost of your grandpa who also happens to have a trail of very tangible silly putty leading directly to the face of the psychic. And he can't talk, and if you try to touch him, he's like spongy. Anyway, whether because you are a straight-up crime fighter or because you are a kind of psychic con artist and you're eventually going to get caught, eventually, let's face it, if you are an ectoplasm psychic, you're going to try to use your ectoplasm for combat. It's a terrible idea, but we know you're going to do it, so here are the rules. First of all, ectoplasm always gets an automatic dodge. In fact, the rules specify that your little spindly floppy ghosticle always has to be controlled by you, except the automatic dodge. It can do that by itself. It just has a natural impulse to jerk away from attempts to, for example, cut the little strand between your head and the projection. So anytime somebody tries to attack the ectoplasm, it like splooshes out of the way. You can use your actions to direct the ectoplasm to do things. It only has a physical strength equal to 4, and unlike a shrunken character with a strength of 4 who still does full damage, an ectoplasm fist, or foot for that matter, if you prefer to kick with your ectoplasm, still does only 1 point of damage. You could also use your ectoplasm to clumsily wield a weapon, but as you can imagine, for a floppy, attenuated, jerky, spongy, amorphous tendril, it is just not a great fencer. You can use a small weapon like a dagger, a hammer, or a club, and you're -4 to strike and parry. You can also, if you are a true fucking idiot, give your ectoplasm tendril a gun, which it can then fire at a -10 to strike, which is markedly worse than just shooting without aiming at all. So, great combat potential for ectoplasm. A+. This will lead to short and interesting combats, I have to give it that. That is what we want from Palladium combat. Note also, like, that's the solid glowing hand of ectoplasm, holding a sword or pulling a trigger on a gun. The vapor can also use a weapon, but it has to be 9 ounces or smaller. So if you want to, you can send your invisible, ghostly, wispy psychic projection, you know, extrude it from your pores, this like ghostly mist floating around your head, and then you like hand it a box cutter and send it to go fuck people up. But it's extremely weak. It's like trying to fuck somebody up with like a marionette who has a box cutter taped to his little hand. It's like that, you know, and working the little cross beam. More of an annoyance than anything. So for combat, this thing is minimally effective. You really don't want to be fighting with ectoplasm. It's mostly good for like seance-style parlor tricks, and even for that, you're not slick. Any illusion you try to create has a wispy trail leading back to your pores. The best you can hope for, really, is that you're going to be left alone in a situation where you normally wouldn't be able to reach something, let's say. You know, it's you're left in a cell, but it's got a barred door, and so you can like reach some ectoplasm out through the bars and do something. Or, you know, you're left alone in one room of somebody's house and you can like reach into the adjacent room, like where you can just barely see and pull something to you. But if you're trying to manipulate anything heavier than 9 ounces, you have to make the visible ectoplasm. And what happens if somebody catches you? What happens if somebody walks in on you while you're trying to do your ectoplasm business? This is the dumbest thing on this page. Quote, half a melee, 7 seconds, is needed to withdraw slash return ectoplasm into its creator. Now, my assumption would have been that despite the fact that ectoplasm is extruded from your pores, like Play-Doh coming out of one of those little Play-Doh presses where you make Play-Doh spaghetti, even despite that, my thought had been up to this point that when you were done with the ectoplasm, it would just sort of evaporate. But no, when you're done with your ectoplasm, you gotta suck it back into your pores. And you can't do this instantly. It takes time. It takes like 7 full seconds. So this raises the very real prospect that you're going to get walked in on while you're trying to do things with ectoplasm. And if you do, then the ectoplasm doesn't just vanish. It starts sucking back into you, but it doesn't take 7 seconds to open a door. So when somebody walks in, they're going to see you with all this shiny, goopy stuff all over your face and the rest of your body as it oozes back into your pores. You know, so like if you were trying to reach a little tendril out of the jail cell bars, to grab the sheriff's gun or whatever. And then the sheriff, you know, forgot his coffee cup or whatever, and he walks back into a little jail cell. You got to like slurp that whole tendril back into you, and you're going to have glowing shit all over your face. If you're lucky, you know, if you hear him coming and you're like, oh shit, I got to hurry, slurp back up that big old hand. What if he comes in, he has the initiative, and he's like, oh, the stories were right. This is that psychic asshole who's been creating floating marshmallow sculptures of people's dead grandpas. And the sheriff, with great presence of mind, grabs onto your psychic hand. What then? He's way stronger. And I don't see any indication here that you can just dispel the ectoplasm, because there are rules here for what happens if it gets destroyed. If somebody wrecks your ectoplasm hand, or your ectoplasm grandpa for that matter, you take 10 SDC and one hit point of damage. So the clear indication is this ectoplasm, once extruded, is not meant to go anywhere. You're supposed to suck it back in, and if you don't, then you take damage. Can you even, like, remote detonate it? If you had an ectoplasm foot out there, and you were feeling real clever, kicking people from the next room over, and somebody grabs that foot and puts it in an ankle lock, I don't think there's anything you can do. I think there is a trail of fucking silly putty leading directly to the perpetrator, you, in the adjacent room, and I think as long as they got that foot, you're in real trouble. I don't think you can deliberately explode the foot. I don't think you can sacrifice it willingly. I think there's a real possibility if they pull on that foot, you're going to fall over, and they're going to drag you by your pores into the next room. I'm not going to pick any one dumb thing on this page. The whole thing is just goofy as hell. There is nothing spooky about this ectoplasm. It is just as funny as I want glowing silly putty to be. This power is comedy hijinks waiting to happen. Anytime you've got a stretchy glowing substance extruding from somebody's pores, you're in for a good time. And this is no exception. I actually sort of like the idea. I don't know whether they were shooting for like slick, semi-psychic con artist here, but if that's the case, they failed. You're not slick. But if they were shooting for bumbling, down on his luck, hack psychic, with one dumb trick he's got to fit to every occasion, this is it exactly. And I would be excited to play that character. Like, for example, if you wanted to make an effective illusion with this power, because of that glowing trail, you'd have to, like, duck behind the sofa and project the illusion over your head, puppet show style. I love this. I love ectoplasm. Today we're discussing page 302 of Heroes Unlimited. We're still talking about ectoplasm. Yesterday we talked about the hilarious hijinks of the psychic master of ectoplasm, who is, in essence, able to pull prehensile strands of chewed gum out of his face, and float them around and try to be spooky with them, or, if he's extremely unwise, give those strands firearms and let him go to town. Today we're discussing another psionic ability, ectoplasmic disguise. This is another application of ectoplasm, a separate psychic power that allows you to, once again, exude gummy ectoplasm from your pores, but in this case, shape it into a flawless disguise. You know, it's like how when you were a kid, if you would ever get served mashed potatoes, you'd be like, I know what I'll do. I'll put these mashed potatoes on my face and mold them, and I'll become the perfect image of the Batman. And it worked. It's like that. Quote, this is an enhanced control over ectoplasm that gives the psychic the ability to cover and disguise his physical features. Ectoplasm is created as normal, with the mysterious pseudo-substance rising from the pores of the skin. Instead of forming wispy tentacles, the ectoplasm covers the face. As it solidifies, it becomes a sort of putty-like material that can be mentally shaped and molded by the psychic. It goes on to say that if you look at an image of someone while you're doing this, then it'll automatically take on the features of the person. So you're not left to just sort of like poke this putty on your face blind until it, you know, looks like Batman or your girlfriend or whatever you're going for. It isn't just your face. It says here that not only does it give you a mask, but it can also change the shape and bulk of your body. Quote, adding a pot belly, muscles, a tail or extra eye, etc. Your chance of successfully disguising yourself using an ectoplasmic disguise is 50% plus 3% per level, which normally I give powers a hard time for giving you about a 50% chance to succeed, but in this case, I think it is eminently fair and extremely generous. It's putty. I mean, it's a goopy substance that has been manually shaped into the shape of someone else's face, just sitting there on your face. You're not going to look like a human being. You're going to look like one of the puppets from the famous Genesis music video Land of Confusion. I'm sorry, it's just science. And the power acknowledges this too. Quote, an ectoplasmic disguise is especially effective from a distance, but does not hold up against close scrutiny. The ectoplasm always has a bit of a dull and pasty appearance, regardless of skin color. If punched, cut, scraped, etc., the ectoplasmic covering will tear away and in a matter of seconds, noticeably reform to cover the tear slash damage. So not only is this just goop, not only is it fistfuls of goop applied to your face and pressed into the shape of someone else's face, it is also dull and pasty. Also note that it covers only your face and like gross changes to your bodily shape. There's no indication here really that it can change your clothes or anything like that. And if the skin is touched or whatever, then it kind of mushes around and then like reforms back into shape in a creepy way. And you gotta constantly keep it in place. It takes constant mental effort to keep this goop where it is. You half your attacks per melee, you take all kinds of penalties, you perform all skills at half, including presumably the impersonation skill, because it's hard to do somebody else's voice when you have to constantly exert willpower to keep your face from falling off. And best of all, let's say that your back's really to the wall, right? You tried to take this disguise thing a little too far. Now either you've got to run, or you've got to perform some skill like impersonation, for example, or, you know, you're pretending to be Ariana Grande and now somebody wants you to sing. So now if you want this unearned adulation to continue, you got to make good. So you got to make your sing skill check. Anytime you have to take concentration away from the disguise, quote, the character must relinquish some his control over the disguise with notable results, like features obviously shifting, drooping, or even melting. Your putty face will melt if you lose focus, or if you try to perform any skill at more than half proficiency, or if you take more than half of your actions per melee. And even when you're concentrating fully, it is basically a big white pasty glob of goop on your face in the shape of a person. This is a terrible disguise plan. This is not what ectoplasm is for. It's for putting out candles, it's for fucking with house cats, and it's for making illusions of dead grandpas. Honestly, if you wanted to impersonate somebody's grandpa, you'd be a lot better off with the marshmallow ghost puppet form, because at least, like, I don't know what a ghost of my grandpa would look like. I'm willing to accept, like, oh, I expected you to be intangible, but you're kind of, like, puffy? Goopy? But fine, like, I have preconceived notions, but I have no evidence about what a ghost is like. If you come up to me pretending to be my living grandpa, and your face is the color and consistency of raw oysters, I know that's not grandpa. And I'm going to be confirmed in this knowledge when I'm like, oh yeah, well then tell me about the old days working at the radio station, and you try to make your impersonation roll, and your nose falls off. Please don't get me wrong, I love this power. I am so happy about it, because this is what I'm used to. This is what I've been missing in the psionics section. After all that talk about superpowers, after this whole book, you know, all I'm looking for is something relatable, something I can get my teeth into. I didn't quite understand what psionics were about during the healing section. It felt like a character from another game that I didn't recognize. But now that we've firmly established that psychics can be characters with goofy comic booky powers that don't really work right, and so they're bound to continually fuck things up and make situations worse, now I'm like, ah, I'm home. This is Heroes Unlimited. This is the game that I fell in love with. Incidentally, for those of you following MDC trivia, the technically dumbest thing on this page is the melting face, which is why I considered this to be an acceptable pick for page 302, even though there's only like one paragraph of this power on this page. It's the paragraph with the melting face. The most important paragraph, I think you'll agree. Today we're discussing page 303 of Heroes Unlimited. We're still in the psionic abilities section, and we're still in the physical psionic abilities, so we're discussing all kinds of ways you can enhance your human body, or your alien body as the case may be, using the powers of the mind. There's a lot of mind over matter kind of stuff here. We're not at super psionics yet, which are more like comic book psionics, big flashy powers. We're still kind of talking about low-key, paranormal mystery, X-Files kind of stuff. And so these powers tend to be pretty low-key, pretty limited, and that's thematically appropriate most of the time. Ectoplasm is a bit of a flashy power to be so weak, but I love it nonetheless. We've spent a couple days talking about it, no need to belabor it, but I do like it. This page has what I think is more characteristic of this section. It's got night vision, so you can just see a little better in the dark, like a cat, kind of. We've got summon inner strength, which allows you to temporarily boost your SDC, your hardiness against poisons, allows you to ignore the effects of fatigue for 10 minutes per level. We've got telekinesis at a pretty low level, spontaneous combustion, but it's not like you immolate someone, you just make a little spark to start a little fire. And we have a bunch of resist powers. These are psychic mind over matter powers that allow you to resist the effects on your body of various detrimental conditions. You can resist fatigue, resist hunger, and resist thirst. The thing about these mind over matter powers, and as self-described, like resist fatigue and resist hunger call out that they are mind over matter powers. The thing about them is that their theme demands that they affect your functioning, but they don't get into like the nitty-gritty of changing your body. This isn't like adapt to environment where, you know, you land on a desert planet and then after spending 6 hours in a coma or whatever, you wake up and you've got a hump like a camel, so now you can handle being denied water physically. This is more like you're dying of thirst, but you're fine with it. You know, you're okay. You're above it, more so than you're immune to it. Resist thirst is an imprecise name for this power. Too cool for thirst would maybe be better. As a result of this design approach, these powers all do basically the same thing, which is to allow you to operate without resources that a human being would normally need to survive. But the wear and tear on your body does take place and is permanent. This is various degrees of ridiculous, depending on the power. Like for resist fatigue, it's fair enough. Quote, a mind over matter discipline which enables the character to engage in physical activity without suffering from exhaustion. Although fatigue is temporarily suspended, the psychic will feel extremely tired and may even collapse when the psi power's time limit lapses. And this lasts for 1 hour plus 20 minutes per level of experience. So a mid-level character, say level 5, you're talking about, what, 2 hours, 40 minutes, something like that? If you're on the brink of exhaustion, 4 inner strength points, you can operate for an hour and 40 minutes at peak efficiency despite being physically dead on your feet. But then afterward, you're going to be wiped. Fair enough. Low fantasy. This is like low-key sci-fi, kind of low-key occult, like paranormal storytelling. Fair enough. Because running around for an hour and a half while you're dead tired will not, in fact, literally kill you. Not so with resist thirst. Here's how that power works. Quote, this ability is fundamentally the same as the resist hunger psi power, except it applies to the consumption of water. It does not negate the long-range damage from dehydration and can result in a coma after 20 days of deprivation. Now note that it says the same as resist hunger, right? Up under resist hunger, it says, it is important to point out that while the psi power makes the person not feel hungry, the body is burning vital sustenance, which could result in malnutrition or starvation. So the effects are happening, right? The effects of not having water in your system are happening. It's just that you are unimpaired by those effects while the power is active, which, by the way, has a duration of 6 hours. Now, it says that after 20 days of water deprivation, you may fall into a coma. Obviously, that's a really long time to operate without water. Good for you. Top-notch psionics, A+. But after like 4 days, you're kind of on borrowed time, aren't you? Like, unless you've got a lot of unfinished business right now, maybe just let it go. Because the minute this power lapses, you drop dead, I think. I mean, you're not coming back from the, quote, long-range damage from dehydration from, like, 5 days without water. You're basically the walking dead after day 4. But I guess that's fair enough. You know, you might be in a situation if you're a player character where you've been without water for 4 days, you now know you're going to lose this character effectively, short of divine intervention, but you got to keep fighting. You got to keep sticking it to evil, so you're going to go as long as you can. Give your character a big dramatic exit. During those, you know, 20 days or whatever that you have, based on this power, your character will continue to be playable and make a certain degree of sense as far as superhero games go. Meanwhile, with resist hunger, and this is the dumbest thing on this page, the horrific attrition of hunger with this power, it's going to put your character through some changes. Quote, another mind over matter discipline that subdues any feeling of hunger, allowing the character to function at full effectiveness without nourishment. It is important to point out that while the psi power makes the person not feel hungry, the body is burning vital sustenance, which could result in malnutrition or starvation. Character loses 3 pounds of weight per day. Note, a psychic can survive without food for up to 60 days, functioning as normal by continually using resist hunger. On day 61, the character will lapse into a coma. So, the good news is, you can make it all the way to day 60. If you are without food, if you are stranded, Shrubbo isn't here for you to eat his limbs, you're out of ration packs, 60 days with no sustenance, and then you get rescued, you could still pull through. But it's really going to be touch and go. You're going to be lying in, not to say filling out, that hospital bed, and you know, your wife is going to walk in and ask the doctor, like, how is he, doctor? And the doctor's going to be like, not good, not good. He's lost about 180 pounds. He's he's only 20 pounds now. That's very low for a man of 6'3", much lower than we recommend. Healthy for a mid-sized dog, mind you, but for a man over 6 feet, 20 pounds is, well, it's going to be a long road back. But we're doing our best. We've found him some doll clothes to wear. That's why you'll see he's in the frilly dress right now. It's really all that we had. We don't normally stock hospital gowns in an American Girl doll size, so we had to make do. 20 pounds. You lose 3 pounds a day. For 60 days, you lose 180 pounds of weight. I mean, this guy's lucky he was 6'3". If you're a psychic woman of small stature surviving 2 months without food, you could be down to nothing by the time they find you, just operating on sheer grit alone. Just wild-eyed, wandering around this desert island in a constant psychic state of fury. Just like, I'm 5'1", I am 0 pounds, I haven't eaten food in 2 months, and I'm going to fucking make it. I think the math on this is the dumbest thing on this page. Without the 3 pound number, we could assume that like you're losing some weight, but maybe it's not quite as much weight as you otherwise would have lost. But with that number, it is truly a goofy image. A worthy addition to the list of stupid psychic powers that we are quickly accruing. If it just didn't specify 3 pounds, then you could skin it in like a dramatic way. I can imagine the chapter of the paranormal novel where this woman is stalking around like she's possessed because she's using her psychic powers to remain whole in body despite the lack of food. But you specify that 3 pounds, we've driven off the edge of drama into the swimming pool of farce. Today we're discussing page 304 of Heroes Unlimited. We're in the psionic abilities section and we're wrapping up physical psionic abilities today. I have just two minor quibbles today with these psionic powers because we're in the T's, which means we're in the tele section of the physical psionic powers, like telekinesis, telekinetic punch, telekinetic leap, and finally teleport object. These are all powers that do things over space, which means they're nice and comic booky, and they're more in like the sweet spot for Palladium rules. They're about doing things to other things. These are the easiest kind of rules to write. It's what Palladium handles relatively well. It was hard to pick a dumbest thing on this page, in fact. Not that the rules are good, they're at their usual level, but not too much stood out to me. And I think partly because these rules are a little bit confusing in some ways. I had two strong contenders, and ultimately I'm going to have to fall on the side of the one that, ironically, is the hardest to judge, because I don't know what this game is talking about. But first, let's start with the runner-up. Teleport object is an interesting psionic power that allows you to teleport away an object that you have at hand to another location. You can teleport the object anywhere within 50 feet per level of experience. It's a one-way teleport, and your success rate with teleporting the object does not change as you level up. It's flat, and it depends on the familiarity of the destination. So teleporting something to anywhere on your person is automatic. No difficulty with that at all. Any further away, and there's a chance of failure. So for example, if you've got your car keys, and you want somebody else to take your car and go do some kind of chore, because you're a hotshot psychic and you don't have time for that. You've got a fraudulent seance with a marshmallow grandpa to work, right? You can't be going to pick up the milk. So you want to teleport your car keys over into somebody's hands, to show off, because that's the kind of person you are. Teleporting your keys into someone's open hands, you have an 88% chance of success, because it's an open space, you can see it, not too difficult. Although I want to point out, your chances of failure are still over 1 in 10. From there, it's all downhill. Directly teleporting your keys into somebody else's pocket, 80%. Teleporting your keys, say, into their car that you've only ridden in a couple of times, 60%. All the way down to a 45% chance to teleport your keys to a completely unknown place, like it says here, quote, down the hall, comma, into the adjoining room. So like places you don't really know, but you know they're around. Like there's going to be a next room. I know this house has a patio, so let me teleport my keys back there so my assistant doesn't need to interrupt me during the seance, that kind of thing. That's a 45% chance. Most of the time, that won't work. What's dumb about this is a combination of things. Number one, your percentage chance to succeed never improves, which means unless you're teleporting things purely from place to place on your body, at some point you're going to fuck it up. You're maxing out at an 88% chance of success in the best of circumstances. And teleporting things onto someone else's person, like into their pocket or their purse, which I would think would be a very common application of this ability. I mean, you could always just hand them the car keys. Typically, when you're spending inner strength points to give something to someone, it's going to be because you need to do it, say, secretly or when you can't get to them. So oftentimes, in important situations, it's going to top out at 80%. Secondly, here's what happens if you fail. Quote, a failed success roll means the teleporter has no idea where the object is, and it could be within a radius anywhere within the character's range. What's funny about this is that, first of all, your radius of effect increases by 50 feet every level. So by the end of the campaign, you have a 450-foot radius. And of course, this means that your area of effect is expanding at a very rapid rate. Within 450 feet is a lot more ground to cover than within 50 feet. Also, get this, on the topic of teleporting things into people's pockets, quote, if in a thick crowd, there is a minus 20% penalty, and a failed roll means it could have been teleported into anybody's pocket. So not only like on a failed roll, it's not like the keys just appear in the air and drop to the ground. They could appear in somebody's pocket. It could be that specific. Unlike the teleport superpower, which on a failure very often lands you inside a physical object, teleported objects don't end up in physical objects, but they do end up in small spaces. Under someone's hat, in someone's underwear, in the wheel well of a car, inside somebody's empty thermos, anywhere within your range, which is increasing every level. So the higher level you are, the worse it is when you fuck up. If you're ninth level, forget those keys. Just have a spare, and if you teleport them away, they're gone. I also feel the need to point out, from like a designer's perspective, that this power does not have the usual language for a role-playing game about being able to teleport unattended objects, which means your ability to teleport away people's equipment and clothing without a save is unfettered. So make of that what you will. This is a power where you could get up to a lot of mischief, but when you fuck it up, you're going to fuck it up good, and you're going to fuck it up more depending on how high level you are. But in any case, none of that really won the day for me because I get what teleporting an object is. I can question the implementation. I can question, you know, do I really want to give a player the ability to teleport away the pants of a supervillain? Do I really want it to be that if you try to teleport the secret microfilm into your ally's pocket and you fail the percentile roll, that it teleports to a random location, potentially a closed or inaccessible one, anywhere within 450 feet? I can question the implementation. But I get what's going on. Not so with the winner, the dumbest thing on this page, telekinetic punch. This is one of those powers where I kind of got to read you the whole thing, and you're going to follow along, and we'll see if you come up with the same questions and the same answers that I do. Quote, telekinetic punch, range, by touch or 1 foot per level of experience. Duration, instant. ISP, 6. Saving throw, none. This telekinetic power enables the psychic to deliver a powerful force through telekinetic energy that feels like a punch or kick. A telekinetic punch will inflict 4d6 plus PS bonus, and a kick will do 5d6 plus PS bonus. The ISP is spent whether or not the punch or kick actually hits the target. Roll to strike as normal. The power is used in conjunction with a normal physical attack, so the telekinetic attack can be parried or dodged by the enemy. Every time the power is used, the psychic must make a save of 14 or higher, or he will take 1d6 points of damage himself as a result of wrenched muscles or a dislocated joint from the extra strain on his body. So, okay, thing number one, you have to make a save without bonuses. 2/3 of the time, you're going to dislocate your goddamn shoulder trying to do a telekinetic punch. So already we're off to a great start here, vying for dumbest thing on the page. But on a deeper level, what the fuck is going on here? So, okay, you've got like limited telekinetic powers that apply only to punching. All right, it's comic books. Fine. What you're doing, keep in mind, it's not like you're just doing a Jedi thing where you're like extending your hand in a sort of like directing the force, like go punch there motion, and then a punch is happening far away from you. You are yourself punching or kicking, and you're doing it hard. You have to, because your physical strength bonus applies to the telekinetic punch. Now, you can telekinetically punch somebody who's right next to you and who actually feels your fist, plus telekinetic bonus damage, or you can make a wild swing over in one corner of the room, and then the person in the other corner of the room feels that punch, just as you swung it, plus telekinetic bonus damage. So I guess what's meant to be happening here is that you are, like, directing the force of the punch through space, I guess without crossing the space in between, because otherwise whoever was between you two might get punched. I guess you're kind of teleporting the force of the punch over to the other person. So you punch over here, they get punched over there. It's a long distance punch. FaceTime for fists, right? So here's my question. How did your shoulder get dislocated? What are you doing? Because what it sounds like you're implying here is that you're telekinetically moving your arm to make it punch harder. But I don't know why you would do that, because they're way over there. I'm also really confused about how they can parry this attack, since they can't see anything. Like, the angle doesn't have to be the same, does it? I mean, presumably you can do this while you're facing away from the person, if you can do it from across the room. So what are they blocking? And where on their body? Like, if you can punch somebody from 20 feet away with your back turned, surely you can make that hit them in the balls, or at least in the lower body, instead of in the face? So how do they know how to even cover up? What do they, how do they know what the timing is? What do they do? How do they dodge? Where do they go? Can you punch them from behind? Sure seems like you should be able to. In any case, as usual with these physical psionic powers, there's a lot of potential for comical fuck-up potential. The worst case scenario is you're like up hiding on the catwalk or the rafters or whatever, looking down on the bad guy. They think they've escaped you, and then you call down to them like, haha, motherfucker, you didn't know about my telekinetic punch. And then you punch, you, for some reason, telekinetically propel your fist way fast, too hard, pop your shoulder out of joint, and then I guess psychically teleport the force down to your opponent, who somehow, with full bonuses, swats this invisible force out of the air with his automatic parry, and you're standing there with a dislocated shoulder on the catwalk, and he's just laughing and laughing. And of course, to bystanders, they have no idea this whole psychic thing even happened. So all they saw is you punch nothing and then scream like a baby and cradle your arm. They're going to be confused. I'm confused. I don't know what's supposed to be happening with the telekinetic punch. And certainly, if nothing else, writing the rules such that you dislocate a joint or wrench a muscle 3 out of 4 times that you use it seems excessive. So this power is the dumbest thing on this page. Today we're discussing page 305 of Heroes Unlimited. We are still in the psionic abilities section, and today we are embarking on sensitive powers. We're talking about sensitive, purely mental powers of the psionic hero, or more accurately, one purely mental power of the psionic hero. This whole page is devoted to a power called astral projection. This is a difficult page for me to do a podcast about because it doesn't feel like it's complete. The astral plane is like obviously a huge, huge topic. It's a huge part of the setting. If you're going to say there's an astral plane in your world, then who could be there? How do you get there? How does it interact with the regular world? And all of these questions are answered in a supplement for another game line, which is plugged twice on this page, Nightbane World Book 1, : Between the Shadows. This supplement, we are promised, describes the whole astral plane, plus the dream stream, which I sort of get the feeling is more Nightbane-y than you would want to bring into your Heroes Unlimited. But anyway, the point is, this is a power that allows you to go to a place, and that place is barely described on this page. Despite all the verbiage, the description of the astral plane is very basic. So that's hard to criticize, right? I mean, it's not like I'm trying to give this page an F. Like, that's not what you tune in for. You're not listening to hear me evaluate this page. Is it good? Probably not. It's a Palladium book. Is it in other ways great? Probably yes. You're here to hear about dumbness, specifically dumb things, and it's hard without context to tell you what's dumb about traveling to the astral plane if I don't know, and I'm certainly not going to go investigate what the astral plane is like in some other game line. There are some little rules issues that I could address, even with the limited information on offer here. For example, on the topic of the connection between your astral body and your physical body, they're connected by a silver cord, as is traditional for astral projection stories. It says, quote, there is only a 30% chance the astral self can locate its physical body without the silver umbilical cord. Roll best 2 out of 3. I don't know what this means because your chances of succeeding at a best 2 out of 3 coin flip are not 30%. And if what this means is you have a 30% chance, roll that 3 times, and if you succeed twice, then you succeed, then your chances aren't 30%. They're more like 10%. I am actually very confused by Palladium's occasional resort to a best 2 out of 3 roll. It seems to happen in cases where your character might die. It's like, to add to the drama, you do it best 2 out of 3, and maybe the author didn't realize that that does affect the math. Like, if it's a 50-50 shot, if it's a coin flip, then 2 out of 3 is just drama. It's just extending the moment. The odds are the same. But if the odds of success are any better or worse than 50%, best 2 out of 3 has different odds from a straight up roll. So it's a confusing rule. But in any case, that's a minor complaint. Likewise, what happens if you lose your physical body? You have to try to find it. And you do this by rolling on a table entitled Location of the Physical Body. There are 4 entries on this table, 1 to 30, hopelessly lost, roll again. 31 to 50, uncertain, confused, roll again. 51 to 76, fairly certain of location, on the right track, roll again. 77 to 100, definitely certain of location, and then in parentheses, woo, made it back. And what you do is you roll on this percentile table until you find your body. You have to be definitely certain to re-enter it. So what we have here is a 4-entry percentile table of essentially flavor text that doesn't matter at all because you're not actually getting any closer to or further away from finding your body. You have, straight up, a 23% chance to find your body every roll. And if you fail, you roll again. That's all. I mean, granted, this is a completely pointless rule that takes up something like 13 lines of an already bloated power. But, you know, it's Palladium. It's par for the course. The mere fact that a rule doesn't work and doesn't matter and is wasting space, you know, that's not even grist for the podcast mill anymore. Today, I don't want to talk about rules, really. I want to talk about a trope that this game only inherits, to be fair, that always bugs me a little bit because of a personal experience I had. It's the trope of astral creatures being visible to the precious young innocents of our world, the children. Quote, astral projection from the physical body into the material world creates a ghostly specter of the astral self, which can be seen only by other psychics, young children under 13 years old, animals, and most supernatural creatures. Psychics, I don't have a problem with. You want psychics to be able to see ghosts and astral projectors and stuff. Supernatural creatures, case by case, but mostly I'm fine with it. Even animals. Sure, what's the harm? Dogs can't try to kill you when you're a ghost. Taps forehead. Be a smart guy. Astral project where you need to go. Those dogs are going to go crazy, but they can't get their teeth into you. Not when you're a ghost. But children, though. I think the idea is that children are like imaginative innocents and aren't believed or listened to by adults. And so they have this secret knowledge of what's going on in the occult world if we would only listen. But that doesn't work. Well, your personal life may or may not involve a lot of children under 13, but there are an awful lot of them out there, a horrifying amount. And, you know, depending on your campaign setting, there may or may not be a lot of ghosts and astrally projecting wizards and wandering dream lords and all that nonsense out in your world. But wherever those things are, there are also going to be quite a lot of young children. You know, if there's an old tourist attraction haunted house that has an actual ghost in it, there's going to be kids in and out of there all day long. Now, if all of them are pure innocents whose imaginations have not yet been corrupted by the responsibilities of age, they're all going to be able to see the ghost. Sometimes there's going to be multiple ones of them in the room who can all see the ghost. And that is palpable. I'll tell you my anecdote, like in lieu of more interesting content for this page, because astral projection, honestly, it's a big bloated power that is on one hand incomplete and on the other hand full of rules that are like slightly off, but who really cares? So in lieu of more to discuss there, let me tell you my anecdote and why this is my pet peeve, why children should not be able to see ghosts in a sort of paranormal modern setting. It doesn't even involve kids. Not really. It's when I was in university and I had this English class up on the second floor. It was some composition or literature class or other. I had it with Mariana Hocus. Big ups to Mariana Hocus, a great teacher. And I'm in this class full of, you know, teenagers, kids in their early 20s, and we're all listening to the lecture. And all of a sudden, this penetrating whine, like not too loud, but this thin, fierce, shrill whine, like a stiletto right through your temple, fires up in the room. And immediately, of course, the room changes. Everybody's just like, what is that? What's going on here? Except for the teacher, except for the instructor who is asking us what's going on, what's wrong. And it comes out over the course of conversation that she, for whatever reason, cannot hear this whine. I think there was maybe one other woman in the class who was a little bit older and also couldn't hear it, but it was just she and the teacher, they couldn't hear it. Everybody else was just being driven crazy by this noise. We tried to go on with the lecture and, you know, everybody sat there and listened and did their best to tune it out. It lasts for a while. And then I'll never forget this. The whine just abruptly stops. And there is this like beautiful, simultaneous and unanimous sigh of relief all over the room. Everybody you can hear the sound of shoulders dropping all over the room. And the teacher instantly picks up on it. It's like, is it gone? Yes, it's gone, Marianne. We're all so happy. Please continue. It was instantaneous. As soon as that whine ended, she, who couldn't hear it at all, instantly knew it was gone because she could see everyone react to it. There is no earthly way, if you are leading a tour group of excitable 10 to 12 year olds, there is no way that if the three of them see a headless fucking man in the middle of the room, that you are not going to have an immediate and palpable understanding that they are reacting to something. Not a chance. You can absolutely feel it when other people see or hear something, especially kids who you know can only act so well, right? I mean, I think we've all watched genre television. We've all watched our share of Star Trek or 1970s action adventure shows. We know kids can't act. So in a world where all children under 13 can see ghosts, there is no fucking secret about ghosts. We would have movies, we would have documentaries, we would have podcasts. It would be like Heaven is for Real times 1,000. It would be 1,000 beautiful burpos all over the world telling us everything we ever wanted to know about the afterlife. And this would be empirically provable because you'd be able to use fast travel in the astral plane to communicate over long distances, child to child, right? You've got one ghost or psychically projected or magically projected wizard or whatever in between, and then you've got a 12-year-old on each end. One 12-year-old in China or wherever tells a ghost something, probably a fart joke, and then the ghost flies to Australia and then tells some Australian child the same fart joke. Someone notes it down. Proved. Done. Ghosts are real, and they love fart jokes, as we always knew that they would. I cannot suspend disbelief that in a world where all children can see ghosts, that we don't know about fucking ghosts, especially over the scope of human history. Special addendum, this relies on ghosts being a relatively common phenomenon. It does not apply to my beloved Quantum Leap and my beloved Al Calavici, who is visible to children, but number one, only sometimes, and number two, there's only one Al Calavici whose appearances across time have been extremely sporadic. So, to sum up, children being able to see ghosts? No, I refuse, I hate it. It is dumb. Number two, the reason we're talking about this at all is because astral projection is a power that is barely finished, and the few rules that are here are clunky garbage. Number three, I do approve of children and animals, and the mentally incompetent, but I don't appreciate their portrayal, being able to see Al Calavici in the television series Quantum Leap, which, like Heroes Unlimited, I know is bad, but I love it. I'm glad we got that all sorted out. Join me next time as we delve ever deeper into the powers of the mind on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. This has been Mega Dumbcast. New episodes drop every day except for Sundays, when all the previous week's episodes drop in one big chunk for your binging convenience. Contact or check out the show wherever you want. It is Mega Dumbcast on Twitter, Instagram, Podbean, your favorite podcatcher, etc., etc. And if you like my tiny little podcast, consider giving me a tiny bit of money at ko-fi.com/megadumb. That is ko-fi.com/megadumb. MDC, Palladium Books, Heroes Unlimited, and all associated trademarks are property of Kevin Sambita. This season's theme song is To the Top by Midair Machine, whose work you can find at freemusicarchive.org/music/askagain. That's ask again, two words with a space in between. Dumbheads, I will catch you next time.